Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. I had the great fortune of sitting down with Jean-Luc Ponte, the fusion violinist who started out playing with Frank Zappa and went on with Mahavishnu Orchestra. So he starts in the beginning where his parents were classical musicians, starting him out with clarinet and piano.
I grew up in a family of professional musicians. My parents were music teachers, but of classical music. So in a small town in France. So my father even founded a music school in that city and was teaching violin and wind instruments. And my mother was teaching piano. And so they started me on both instruments, violin and piano, when I was 5 years old. I grew a passion for music immediately. As young as 6, 7 years old, I wanted to be a musician. They asked me to choose one instrument between violin and piano when I was 11, so that I would really focus on one instrument and become good at it instead of mediocre on two or three instruments. My father taught me clarinet as well. They sent me to study in Paris. When they understood I really wanted to become a professional musician, they said, then you have to read the right way. You have to study and get a diploma. And, you know, they were worried about me making a living, basically. I went to Paris when I was 17, I think, about 15, even 15. And I got admitted at the top school, music school in France, in classical music, the Paris Conservatory. And so I studied there classical violin for 2 years and graduated. I first studied violin as my main instrument. And when I was 13 years old and I had decided to become a professional musician in classical music at the time, that's all I knew. My parents said, then you have to really study seriously. So it was like 4 or 5 hours a day. Then they sent me to the Paris Conservatory, which was the only top school in France at the time where you could study at the level to become a professional musician. So clarinet was my third instrument after piano was second and clarinet was third. But I loved clarinet. I kind of liked it. And I never thought of playing jazz on violin at first. And that's why when I met a group of amateurs, you know, they were students, and they had a jazz group in Paris and they were looking for a clarinet player, the Benny Goodman style. That's why I volunteered. I said, great. I know nothing about jazz, but so they auditioned me and I could improvise right away. That I discovered I had this ability to improvise. So because of that, they hired me and that's how it all started. Then one day I didn't have my clarinet. I wanted to jam with a band that was doing a live show. It was somewhere in France. And I only had my violin. I said, okay, then I'll still go on stage, but with my violin. And that's how I found out that I could play jazz on violin. And in fact, that I liked it a lot. And the audience, too, reacted very strongly. So that's when I got the idea to play jazz on violin. And so I finished my studies, got my diploma at the conservatory, you know, still playing Mozart and Bach on the whole week. And then on the weekends, I would go play jazz and clarinet and violin. And then I was quickly noticed in Paris first, then in Europe as a jazz violinist, because there were very few, plus the very few who were jazz violinists were from the previous generation playing an older style of jazz, the swing style of the 40s, 50s. And I was into modern jazz, bebop, post-bop, Miles Davis, John Coltrane. So I got noticed very quickly in the European jazz circles. But since I needed to amplify, I mean, that was one of the things I realized immediately when I started playing jazz on violin, that the volume of the instrument was not enough to play with drums and a regular rhythm section. So there was not much equipment available at the time, but I found something that had been used, in fact, by an Afro-American violinist from the 40s, 50s, Stuff Smith. It was very primitive, you know, just a pickup you put on the table of the violin, but that was enough for me to plug in a guitar amp and get even louder than horn instruments then. And that attracted the attention of rock musicians because I got that electric sound. And that's how I first was invited to play with the guys in London, in England, and in Germany as well. There were progressive musicians already being between jazz and rock and with the new electric instruments. And then eventually I got noticed by a record label from Los Angeles, Pacific Jazz. And I signed my first record contract with an American label and went to Los Angeles to spend quite a good part of the year in 1969. And in fact, the record producer, when he saw me playing live in clubs in Los Angeles, I guess he realized there was that electric edge that might appeal to the rock audience. And he had heard that Frank Zappa was looking to do a project, a jazz project, and perhaps a collaboration with jazz musicians. So he's the guy, that record producer, he was the guy who got the idea of calling to call Frank and suggest that he would be the producer for my next solo album. What happened is we got an appointment at Frank's house, and Dick Bach, the record producer, played a live recording I had just did in a local club, and with George Duke. I had discovered George Duke, who was an unknown young keyboard player, and we started together. I started a quartet with George. And so Frank liked it immediately and accepted right on the bat to produce my album. And my record producer gave him a blank check. He said, you know, you do what you want, your music, you arrange your music for an instrumental version of your music for Jean-Luc's next album. And also he gave him the responsibility to choose, hire the musicians and everything, the studio engineer and all. So my only demand was that I would have George Duke with me, so that at least I would have one musician that was, you know, familiar with, and we had a strong connection. So that's how Frank, in fact, discovered George Duke. And very soon after, within a couple of weeks, 3 weeks max, we were in the studio recording that album that was called King Kong. And even though Frank at that time was already recording another album in the studio, which was Hot Rats. So I was impressed how, wow, efficient and fast he was. And then, so that album was kind of revolutionary because, you know, there was not much music like that at the time, so it got noticed worldwide. 2-3 years later, Frank asked me to join his band, to start touring with the Mothers, which I did accept. And that's when I moved to Los Angeles, and that was 1973.
What a great year to have been alive as a young, aspiring fusion musician. It was so alive, and things were just changing left and right. Now he goes on to tell me how he got the Mahavishnu Orchestra gig with John McLaughlin.
I toured for about a year with Frank. Then I wanted to start my own band. So I left the Mothers, and I think the next day or 2 days after, I got a call from McLaughlin to join Mahavishnu. So because we had met, we knew each other. And so that was a tough choice for me because I had written music, new music, and I was looking for a record deal, and I was preparing to record a demo, find a deal. And then John calls me and I I said, wow. So it was either join the band that was already very famous and tour the world, or start riding in a car through the US, going to perform in clubs with my own band. No, plus the music was so exciting. You know, I was very, very impressed by John's material and the sound of the Mahavishnu. So I said, okay, I'll postpone my own project for a little while and join Mahavishnu. Interestingly enough, when I met Billy Cobham later, he told me that he wanted me to join the first band. But I was not living in the States at the time, so it was kind of complex, you know, not an easy thing to bring me over and so forth. So they looked for a violin player in America, and it was Jerry Goodman who did such a great job. But then I was part of the second version of the Mahavishnu with Narada Michael Walden on drums, Ralph Armstrong on bass, and there was a string quartet and two horns. Because in fact, the first album I did with Mahavishnu was with a symphony orchestra. And so we recorded that in London with the London Symphony, and then went on tour, and of course could not afford a symphony orchestra to travel with us. So John, you know, got the idea of hiring this string quartet. It was a small version of a symphony, very small version, but at least we could play that material. So it was very exciting. And the energy of John's playing was quite a stimulation for me to be on stage. We were touring a lot, almost nonstop through the year. So it made me a very strong player just to be on stage with, sharing the stage with him. And we were both the main soloist of the band, me and him in front of the group, you know, so that was a great experience. Then I thought it was time to just dive in and try. And I did, because in the meantime, I had done my demo in Los Angeles, and Atlantic Records offered me a contract while I was still with Mahavishnu. So I managed to record my first album in between tours with Mahavishnu, and it got released. That's when I decided to start my own band, because as much as I admired John's music, I really loved his compositions and the material. The name of the game with his band was that it was just his music. So I really felt that edge to write my own music. The only way was then to start my own band, my own group. That's what I did, and was lucky enough to be successful with it very quickly, because by the third album, Imaginary Voyage, it was on top of the charts, in the jazz charts and also in the pop charts, the top 40s. So it took off very quickly for me. I had met local musicians in Los Angeles while I was in Zappa's band, not people related to Zappa, but local jazz musicians, and who had participated to my demo, for instance, but they were not all available. Like, for instance, Patrice Rushen was a great young pianist. I think she was 17, 18 when she did the demo with me. And so she still was at university. And when I started touring, maybe she was 21, but still her parents wanted her to keep studying, so she was not available for touring. So I had to look for new musicians, except Tom Fowler, the bass player who was with Zappa, together with me. When he heard I was putting a band together, he called me up and volunteered to join me. He wanted so much to play jazz or a music that was more jazz-oriented than being with Zappa's band, that he joined my first band, indeed. Then I was asking around for a recommendation. You know, I was looking for a guitar player, and George Duke had met a young guy while he was on tour in the US, in Milwaukee, Daryl Sturmer. And George told me that guy would be great for you. And so I flew him over to LA and auditioned the guy and hired him immediately. Yes, indeed, he was the right guy. A few years later, he got offered to join Genesis. You know, I had not been taking off yet with success, and I said, don't miss that opportunity. You know, it's too bad for me, but it's good for you. So up to that point where I started my band, I had done a lot of collaborations. I was doing almost only that, and I got a lot of requests to participate to recordings. And well, in fact, Stanley Clarke and Chick Corea offered me, when I left Mahavishnu, offered me to join Return to Forever. And that was another tough choice. It took me at least a month to think about it. But I said, okay, now I have to really try my own project. And once I started to have a band and started touring, I started touring nonstop as well. First, a lot in the US, but also in Europe and later on South America. And so it became really my priority to develop my own musical concept and my sound and stick to it until the late 80s. So that I started in 75. So I'd say for 15 years, I even refused any other offers or accepted very, very rare invitations to do a solo on someone's album. But after 15 years, I still wanted to keep working with my own band and developing my own music as my priority. But I also became a little more hungry for new projects as well, because as an artist, it's always stimulating. There is nothing worse than routine. It's dangerous even for, you know, for the creativity. So while touring in Europe, being in Paris, I met some West African musicians from ex-French colonies who had moved to Paris. And I was very intrigued because I had listened to African music in my youth, but that was tribal African music. And so I was curious to hear what younger musicians, modern African musicians, they were using electric bass, electric guitar, you know, modern instruments. So I really discovered another world, you know, very rich in rhythm patterns. So that got me the idea of doing a project with them. In the early 90s, I went to Paris I was hunting around to find African musicians and put a whole group together and did an album called Chocola, which was exclusively exploring the music of West African countries like Cameroon, Mali, Senegal. And I had musicians from each of these countries that would ask them to conceive original material, new pieces based on the rhythms of their native countries. And Chocola has nothing to do with chocolate, but it's a T-C-H-O-K-O-L-A. And it's in a tribal language from Cameroon. It means healing. It's a shaman, you know. I like that title. That's why I chose it. You know, it was very enriching for me rhythmically. Then I came back to my own music using percussionist following that experience and keep developing my own music. I must say to this day, I'm still doing it. It was really very authentically native rhythms from these different countries. So the scales usually are very repetitive. It's hypnotic music, you know, it's very simple melodically, but yet I had to adapt. Some of the rhythms you could tell were like the roots of some of styles in American music, but there were some other rhythms, like from Cameroon. There are so many different tribes in Cameroon and different styles of music. And I had hired a drummer who was from a specific tribe, and they had the rhythm patterns was like there were two or three rhythms together, polyrhythms. Really not easy for me to feel, you know. I could analyze. Being a sophisticated musician, you can do that. You can write it down. You can study. Okay, but to really feel it and play it the right way, that's another thing. And I remember he showed me, we recorded that piece of him. He composed it based on the rhythm of his country. We recorded it, and after that, you know, he was lodging at my place, at my home in Los Angeles for a month, and he showed me a video of his family at a funeral ceremony that lasted 3 days. And these people were not really dancing, but like walking in a line, queuing up, and bouncing in rhythm, on that rhythm. And that's when I understood how it should feel. And so I decided to erase what we had done, and I recorded it again. And it was much better. So that was quite an interesting experience.
That's what I love about fusion musicians like Jean-Luc Ponte. They're so creative, and they're always looking forward to see how they can push the envelope. Now he explains how Al Di Meola and Stanley Clark approached him in the 90s to do a collaboration together.
In the mid-90s, Al Di Meola suggested, he contacted me and Stanley Clark to do an acoustic project as a trio. And at first, I was just coming out of this African experience. I was not sure. I said, well, that's taking me somewhere so opposite. I don't know if I'm ready to do that. But he came to LA and we tried and say, wow, yeah, that's also very stimulating. It's totally different, but with no rhythm section. When he was taking a solo, I had to fill in and do some rhythmic patterns, which I had never done before. So that was a very interesting experience as well. Plus, him and Stanley are such strong players who also love to do their own solo. And at first, I was not that much into showing my virtuosity. That's not really my personality so much. You know, after they got on stage and each did their numbers, I said, okay, I have to do it. And eventually I did it and came up also with a solo. So that's what I meant before. You know, it was good for me to accept different collaborations like that, stimulating ones. The type of experiences that push your limits. Another collaboration later on in 2011 was when Stanley and Chick renewed their invitation to join Return to Forever because they were doing a reunion tour. So then I said, okay, this time, yes, I'll do it. At least this way I won't have missed the offer because I love Chick and Stanley. And it was such a great experience again. That level of players being on stage, it's amazing. It's great. What I loved is that, again, we were all on an equal level. You know, Chick was kind of like making sure, coordinating, but not imposing just his leadership, was really open to serve the music of the other guys in the band. When whoever was the composer of the piece would be the leader. Everyone else in the band would be at the service of that composition, including Chick when it was my composition, for instance. So that was a great experience. I loved it. Lenny White and Stanley and Frank Gambale on guitar.
That's a wonderful experience he had with Chick Corea, actually letting him be able to be the band leader on the compositions that he wrote. Now he explains the evolution of the electric violin and how he worked with various manufacturers.
Initially, the reason I amplified the instrument was to get more volume, indeed. So when I was with Frank, I bought a big guitar amp in those days, but it was a double stack. And I was as loud as a rock guitarist, for sure, even louder. Also, because in the meantime, in California, I had been approached by Barkus Berry. Right when I was with Zappa, in fact, even before when I was playing with George Duke in clubs in Los Angeles, John Berry, co-owner of Barkus Berry, came to to a club one night and gave me one of their electric violins. It was a red one at the time. That's when I started to have real electric instrument that could be as loud as an electric guitar. And yet these were more like electroacoustic. There was still a regular violin body, you know, with the holes, and it was a case. So, you know, it was muffled as an acoustic instrument because of the thick layer of paint, of lacquer that was on it. They put on purpose. In fact, they explained to me that they were using lacquer for cars, very thick, so that it would soften, damp the volume of the instrument and get less feedback. Because that's what I was going to say. With this type of electroacoustic instrument, you could only reach a certain level beyond which you could easily get feedback, depending on the level of the band behind you, of course, especially Mahavishnu. You know, with Zappa, in fact, it was pretty contained because there was wind instruments, like Ian Underwood was playing sax or clarinet. His wife, Ruth, at the time, was playing marimba, you know, vibraphone. So, but Mahavishnu, we were really loud. So in the mid-80s came Zeta, again from California, but they were in Oakland, in fact. They made the first solid body, although I think Fender did it first, in fact. At the time when I tried it, I prefer the Zeta. Zeta became my main instrument in 1985, I believe, 84, 85, around that time. Once I got used to it, because with solid body, then I could, no feedback. The presence in the house was the best. Yeah, people told me in the audience that it was like, you know, right to your nose and very clean and clear. And in fact, for the type of music I do now, I came back to more a blend of acoustic and electric, and I'm coming back to the electroacoustic instruments a lot more, but still using the solid body, the Zeta, on some pieces. You know, when the energy and the volume gets really high up there, it's more adapted to that. But it's true that with the electroacoustic, especially Barkus Berry made one that's wood finish, and that one can sound acoustic as well. Indeed, you get that sound near your ear. You get that, which you don't get with a solid body violin, of course. What I should explain is that first the concept started to get more volume, but then when I arrived in California and started working with Frank, and they were a lot of new effects, you know, sound effects, devices being invented. Like I remember Tom Oberheim coming to a rehearsal with Zappa, having Frank try one of his new prototypes, phase shifter. And so Frank would tell me, since I had an electric violin, yeah, try it. So I would, and that solved very quickly. And then the digital delays, wah-wah pedal. So suddenly I got into discovering all these sound effects that I would be experimenting with them and select the one that worked. They're like a guitar player, I could plug in these things. But then there were effects that worked better than others with the violin sound. But that's how I got to really experiment full speed with that as soon as I was in California in the early 70s. You know, there were a lot of new devices coming up, and that's so, and it also influenced my writing somehow. I was hearing some sound effects that would make my mind travel out of space, you know, or that inspired me to write some pieces using these sounds. So I would say that between 1975 and up to the 90s, I got really into electronic sounds a lot with the violin. Yet once in a while I would do one acoustic piece. I would still take my classical violin in the studio and maybe do one solo or one piece that would be different from the others, totally acoustic, but really the majority of the sound and the sound signature was really electric, for sure, for many years. So for a long time I used amps on stage. But eventually, now I'm only going through the sound console and monitors on stage. At first, I was looking for a modern sound to adapt the sound of the violin, which is so traditional, to the new music I was playing, you know. And I felt that to get it more modern, it worked if I transformed that sound with effects. But then, starting with the Zeta in the mid 80s, the sound, the dry sound of the violin by itself was so good and so modern that I felt not as much the need to transform the sound anymore and use that many effects anymore. You see, so that's why I started also to record direct, because I could get the big, fat, and modern sound I wanted. Yeah, I still use my Barkus Berry from 1981, the wood finish mostly, but I still have my blue one also. It's such a good sound, and the Zeta.
That's amazing. It stands the test of time. Both his violins that were custom made for him. And he's got such a unique sound as well. And it's so cool that he could actually treat it like a guitar player with pedals. Now he explains his new projects.
I continue touring with my own bands and do other collaborations on the side. So lately, due to the demand of many fans around the world, I finally accepted to do a reunion of my American band and revisit the music from my early albums on Atlantic, the first 10 years, you know, and play the material from albums that my fans like the most, like Imaginary Voyage, Enigmatic Ocean, Cosmic Messenger, and all that. Because I'm not the kind of guy that is really into nostalgia and looking back all the time. I'm so much in the present. As long as I can, you know, physically do it, I'll keep doing it. But I must say that when thinking about it and listening to these early albums, although the sound was great at the time and the energy, what we have today in terms of sound equipment, PA systems, monitors, preamps, which I use for the violin, are so high quality compared to what we had, that it's also a pleasure to play this music again with the sound of today. Not necessarily trying to get exactly that sound we had at the time. We respect the structure, the melodies, and the kind of sound, but without really rehashing the past. It's really playing it again and making it new somehow. But at the same time, I do sometimes shows with a symphony orchestra. I started getting arrangements for orchestrations for my music to play with symphony orchestras or big band. And once in a while, I'm invited to do some other collaborations. Like 2 years ago, it was with a French gypsy jazz guitarist, Birelli Lagrange. He's an amazing guitar player. To me, he's really the best since Django Reinhardt. And he can play modern, too, because he's much younger than me. He must be early 40s, maybe, or late 30s right now. And, of course, he started playing that gypsy jazz style like Django Reinhardt, but he can play modern, too. And there was Kyle Eastwood on bass. We also did an album with Birelli and Stanley Clark as a trio. So I like a side project once in a while. Keeps my mind alert, you know. And I must say it's a reward for me. It makes me very happy to see there are now younger generations of violinists who really are good. It really makes me feel good because for such a long time in the 70s and even 80s, I was looking around and felt kind of lonely. I said, maybe it's too crazy to do what I'm doing. Nobody else wants to go into that. But finally now I see younger fiddlers who go into adapting their instrument to modern music, who follow my path or not, but I have the same concept. And that makes me very happy because once I will be away, then I know the chain will go on. In fact, yes, I have more and more fans among the young classical string players I'm often contacted by some who want to know where they can learn modern music, you know, how to improvise and sound equipment and all that. So yes, it's very different. I was looked at as a bad boy, you know, violin. I mean, me and Jerry Goodman and the few like us who were using electric violins, we were really the bad guys, viewed like the bad guys by the classical string players. Most of them, I mean, there were always a few who were kind of admiring that some crazy guys like us would be daring to do. But it has changed now, yeah. I can tell also when, as I said, I play my music sometimes with symphony orchestras, and I've done it in Brazil, in the States. I did it in New York, also in the Brazil, Russia, Germany, France, and the young players in the orchestra always come to talk to me and narrative and ask me for advice and this and that. So yes, you're right. There is an openness of mine that's be much larger than nowadays than it was before.
It's so nice to hear that new classical musicians are open to new forward progressive thinking playing, and that they're actually embracing Jean-Luc's style. Now here's Jean-Luc Ponte with Parisian Thoroughfare.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Jean-Luc Ponty, and you are listening to Guitar Tracks, the best instrumental music station on the Florida Space Coast.